Your North Carolina Reading Service, formerly Triangle Radio Reading Service, presents the journal Indie Week. This edition, dated January 8th, 2020. Reading for a blind and print-impaired audience, I am John Federson. And this issue will begin right away with an article from a column now called Voices, Quiet as It's Kept, by Alexis Pauline Gumbs. It was a holiday, so downtown Durham was quiet, completely quiet. Even the constant buzz of construction machinery in a gentrifying city had taken the day off. All the shops, offices, and restaurants were closed. The city hushed, and families huddled in at home. Or, that's what you might think, unless you heard the screaming. I lived near the downtown jail and happened to walk by on that quiet day, given the air slits that pass for windows at the jail and the height of the sound, I couldn't see what was happening. All I know is what I heard. One heart-wrenching scream and then a chorus of screams following. The sound echoed off the glass of the empty Durham Performing Arts Center, the Fox 50 station, the vacant parking lots. I don't know whether the scream was from someone being physically harmed, and a chorus rose up in witness. I don't know if it was the sound of protest. I do know that some famous prison rebellions have taken place during the holidays, when fewer guards come to work, and the heartbreak of being separated from family on a day of celebratory gathering is palpable. I haven't heard any news of a full-scale rebellion in the downtown jail in recent months, but I know what I heard. It was a tortured sound that I never would have been able to perceive, except for the fact it was the only sound, and I happened to be within earshot. A person screaming became people screaming. And for a moment there was a break in the profound silence of the routine absurdity of hundreds of people, not even convicted of any crime, forcibly kept away from their loved ones during the holidays. The guttural sound of a longing for home. Mostly, the systemic homelessness Durham reproduces is quiet, easily drowned out by the sound of bulldozers, traffic, and the promise of opportunities for some. It is the mold growing quietly on the walls of rental properties, ravishing immune systems all over this city of medicine. It is the quick installation of a plastic gate preventing anyone from sitting or sleeping in the shelter of the underpass of my exit off 147, and the evictions and price outs that make such a gate necessary. It is the tragedy of two babies dying in their sleep in the last 2 months of 2019, and the possibility that it might be linked to the toxicity of the air inside the Durham Housing Authority's neglected McDougal Terrace homes. There are many silent ways that the myth of home is shattered here in Durham, but usually you can't hear it while it's happening, unless somebody screams. Guess what, Durham? The screaming has started. The Stop Evictions Now Coalition has emerged to draw attention to the fact that all year, but especially during the holidays, too many families lose their homes and have few safe options. Now in the new year, concerned parents and community members at McDougal Terrace are demanding that the DHA address the gas leakages, carbon monoxide, broken heating systems, and general structural negligence affecting the physical health of residents. The bravery of the activists who are raising their voices at McDougal and seeking to intervene in evictions citywide is beautiful. And it reminds me of June Jordan's poem published 50 years ago, For Beautiful Mary Brown, Chicago Rent Strike Leader. In that poem, Jordan honors the work of those protesting unlivable housing conditions in Chicago with these words, You will be God to bless you. I hope that in this new decade we can learn from what this holiday season has taught us, that for many of us the idea of the holidays as warmth, home, cozy connection, and culinary and consumerist cheer is only a dream. For many Durham residents, so-called holy days actually represent a crisis in dignity and an existential contradiction. There are so many ways that the safety and warmth of home, our most basic human right, is a fantasy right now in Durham. Daily bulldozed by rhetoric that doesn't account for the anguish in our midst. And alongside those who seek to stop evictions and guarantee safe housing for all Durham residents, I imagine a Durham blessed not by the forced silence of disempowerment, but by the peace of a people safe at home, honored at the level of our breathing. That's something I can believe in. That's something I would celebrate. Imagine that holy day when we can stop screaming and sing. Next, another new titled feature, 15 Minutes, as in 15 Minutes of Fame. This week talking about Kerwin Pittman, 32, community activist, director of Recidivism Reduction Educational Program Services. Lee Taus wrote this. What makes Raleigh home? They ask. He answers, I grew up here. Raleigh is home because my family's from here. I know the different situations that plague Raleigh, be they housing, job opportunities, police brutality, a wide range of different things from the old to the young. I know they will affect my family members. Our roots are in Raleigh. Question, what's your biggest hope for 2020? To see better transparency from the Raleigh Police Department when dealing with the community, and to see more transparency across the nation when dealing with different government entities, especially the White House. I want the people to be spoken for more, because now it just seems like the establishment has the voice and the people are being trampled upon. What's your favorite place in Raleigh? The Martin Luther King Jr. statue is one of my favorite places to go and meditate. I go there sometimes and sit in my car. Sometimes I go out by the statue. Meditating for me looks like me putting my different ideas, my different goals and views into perspective. Taking the frustration that I might have felt that day, that week, that month, and dealing with different things I have going on, and seeing how I can put it in a positive and productive perspective. It looks like clearing my mind, taking some time out for myself. Being a community activist, it's easy to get out of focus and get off track because you get so invested in the different issues, you lose focus. These issues can consume you, but you can't let them consume you. Right on the next page, the good, the bad, and the awful. Good, Stephanie Hofeller. On Sunday, Stephanie Hofeller published her late father's files on a new website, thehofellerfiles.com. After Thomas Hofeller died in 2018, Stephanie turned over the GOP gerrymandering guru's files over to Common Cause, which was suing the General Assembly over the NCGOP's objections. The bombshells they contained not only helped force the General Assembly to redraw legislative and congressional districts last year, but they also showed that the Trump administration's efforts to add a citizenship question to the census were politically motivated. Next, the bad. Durham Fire Department. Last month, when concerns about carbon monoxide at McDougal Terrace first surfaced, Durham Fire Department Assistant Chief Andy Sinopoli told the News and Observer that, quote, there was no indication that carbon monoxide had contributed to the recent deaths of two infants in Durham's largest public housing complex. Under pressure from activists, however, the city walked that back. Last Thursday, EMS Assistant Chief Lee Van Vliet admitted that the infant's autopsy report hadn't been completed, which means that, well, yeah, it's possible carbon monoxide played a role after all. The next day, DHA began voluntarily relocating McDougald residents. And finally, the awful. Tom Tillis. When his primary challenger dropped out, the country's most vulnerable incumbent could have put a little daylight between himself and President Trump, but that's not Tom Tillis's play this year. Blind, feckless allegiance is. So, when Trump droned Qasem Soleimani on Friday, Tillis went on Pat McCrory's radio show to proclaim that it's reckless to do anything but thank the president. A very 2003 sentiment. The next day, in an embarrassingly gratuitous bit of A-kissing, Tillis asked his Twitter followers to sign a birthday card for Eric Trump, an American patriot. That tweet got ratioed, that is, more replies than retweets or likes, an indication of internet mockery, like nothing we've ever seen. As of Monday morning, it had 18,400 replies to a combined 732 RTs and likes. And another brief article, a week in the life. Here's what happened since Indy went to press last week. That was on New Year's Day. On the 31st of December, a federal judge struck down North Carolina's voter ID law, arguing it was impermissibly motivated by discriminatory intent. Attorney General Josh Stein said he'll appeal, but voters won't have to show ID in the March primary. North Carolina is likely to gain one congressional seat following the 2020 census. And the Raleigh-Durham International Airport announced its annual passenger count grew by more than 10% from 2018 to 2019. And New Year's Day, Symphony Rudolph, the first baby born in the Triangle in 2020, arrived at UNC Rex in Raleigh at 12:17 a.m. Duke Energy on January 2nd agreed to relocate about 80 million tons of coal ash by 2038 as part of an unprecedented settlement with the Department of Environmental Quality and environmental groups. A report from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security found no evidence that Russian hackers had breached the computer system Durham County used during the 2016 election. And the Wake County Library System did away with late fees and expanded its checkout period from 2 weeks to 3. January 3rd, after a U.S. airstrike killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad, the U.S. began deploying 3,500 soldiers from Fort Bragg to the region, one of the most rapid deployments in decades. The State Department of Commerce said North Carolina added 124,000 jobs between November 2018 and November 2019. Unemployment decreased in 92 of 100 counties, including all 15 metro counties. And Mike Bloomberg's experiment in purchasing the presidency opened an office in downtown Raleigh. January 5, hundreds gathered at Halifax Mall on Sunday to protest the Trump administration's move toward war with Iran. About 100 anti-war veterans and protesters amassed in Durham as well. January 6th, after a bloody 2019, Durham notched its first homicide of 2020 when police discovered a man fatally shot in the 700 block of Gray Avenue. Inc. magazine named Durham the third best city in the country to start a business, behind Austin and Salt Lake City. Raleigh placed 16th. All three Al's Burger Shack locations filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, listing assets of less than $50,000 against liabilities ranging from $500,000 to $1 million. The company said it, quote, overextended during expansion. Al's recently announced that it would add a fourth location as part of Beer Steady's expansion in Durham. And finally, on the 7th, Go Triangle unveiled its first two electric buses at an event at Raleigh's Union Station. Now we're starting our more in-depth long-form columns, first from Raleigh, called Free Ride by Lee Taus. Could Raleigh make its buses free? Sure, but it won't be simple. Across the country, cities are looking to expand bus transit as a way to alleviate traffic congestion and combat climate change. The goal is the same, more riders and fewer cars on the road. Last year, Kansas City became the first large city to make its bus system completely free, something the smaller Chapel Hill did back in 2002, which has spurred talk that perhaps Raleigh, with a new city council committed to improving public transportation, could follow suit. It's not clear how much that would cost. Each day, riders make about 18,000 trips on Go Raleigh buses, paying at least $1.25 a ride. These trips add about $3 million to the city's coffers a year. Eating that cost would require roughly a 0.5% property tax increase. But there would also be savings. Go Raleigh would no longer need to print tickets or maintain ticket vending machines, as well as additional expenses such as higher maintenance and security costs associated with more ridership. So the real price tag is difficult to calculate, says Michael Moore, city's transportation director. What's more important, he says, is figuring out what the city really wants to accomplish, a more equitable bus system or better ridership. Sometimes making it fare-free doesn't actually improve ridership a whole lot, Moore says. What people see as a barrier to transit ridership is the frequency and reliability. It's not always the cost. If the bus isn't going where you want to go when you want it to go, it doesn't matter what it costs at that point. That wasn't the case in Chapel Hill, which saw ridership nearly triple after implementing its no-fare system, says Transit Director Brian Litchfield. Fares only make up about 12% of the bus system's budget in 2001, making it pretty easy to absorb the cost, Litchfield says. The town went from 2.6 million annual riders in 2002 to about 7 million now. Kansas City hasn't gotten its zero-fare system up and running, but it will probably cost about $8 million a year, according to spokesman Chris Hernandez. Kansas City plans to fund it through a combination of sales taxes, property taxes, and federal grants. The key to Chapel Hill's success hinged on partnerships, Carrboro and UNC Chapel Hill, which fund about 64% of the system's $24 million budget. Raleigh's fares comprise only about 8% of Go Raleigh's operating budget, the bulk of which comes from taxpayers, the Wake County Transit Plan, and grants. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin says eliminating fares would likely require a joint effort with Go Triangle. The Regional Transit Alliance is planning a study to explore what that might look like. That doesn't mean the Raleigh City Council won't look into abolishing fares during this year's budgeting process, Baldwin says, but because the council already plans to ask taxpayers to shell out hundreds of millions of dollars in bonds for Dix Park and affordable housing, she's wary of asking for too much too soon. I think this is very doable, Baldwin says. I'm thinking it's going to take us a little longer, though, than 2020 to figure it out. So what I would suggest that we look at this as an opportunity for 2021. Councilmember Nicole Stewart says the city should see bus rapid transit through before pushing a fare-free system. Bus rapid transit is included in Wake County's transit plan, which voters approved in a referendum in 2016. That means dedicated bus lanes, more pickup times, and speedier service. I think it's worth exploring the idea of a fare-free system, but we can't lose sight of our current priority of bus rapid transit, Stewart says. For now, the council plans to look into a fare capping system to ensure that those who pay by the ride don't pay more than the cost of a monthly pass. From Durham, Thomas E. McDonald's Poisonous Air. Two dead kids, too many questions at McDougal Terrace. This week, Durham Housing Authority officials began relocating more than 300 residents of McDougal Terrace into hotels because of concerns about potentially dangerous levels of carbon monoxide in their homes. But a question lingers among residents of the 67-year-old housing complex, the city's largest. Did carbon monoxide poisoning kill two infants? On Thursday, a day before the DHA announced the voluntary relocation, residents and community advocates gathered at Burton Elementary School for a Q&A session with DHA officials, who were joined by EMS and fire department officials who had spent the previous week checking apartments' carbon monoxide levels. Those inspections found 6 units with elevated carbon monoxide levels and 13 more with gas leaks. In addition, paramedics reported 4 residents with elevated carbon monoxide levels, two of whom required hospitalization. Despite those results, Fire Department Assistant Chief Andy Senipoli told the News and Observer that, quote, there was no indication that carbon monoxide led to the deaths of infants on November 20th and December 8th. But at Thursday's meeting, not everyone accepted that assurance. Victoria Peterson, a former city council candidate, told DHA Executive Director Anthony Scott that she wanted to cut to the chase and through the rumors. I heard the two children died. I don't know if that's true or not, so I would like you gentlemen to speak on that. I would like to know, have any children died? Have any children gone to the hospital? Scott called the notion that infants were dying at McDougald a rumor that's been out there for a while, before adding that he was told by the fire department that there was no indication that the deaths stemmed from carbon monoxide poisoning. Peterson pressed. She asked Scott and other officials if they'd seen the autopsy reports. Told the reports hadn't been completed, she said, so there's a possibility that carbon monoxide could be what's happening? Yes, ma'am, answered Assistant EMF Chief Lee Van Vliet. Scott assured residents that addressing the carbon monoxide scare was his highest priority, but that's just one issue above many, among any. That's just one issue among many. To live there, current and former residents said Thursday, is to be subjected to a barrage of third-world condition. That place needs to be shut down, a former resident said. What I've heard today is unfathomable. You need to contact Washington. It's an emergency. The residents described hearing rats in their walls, smelling mold in their kitchen cabinets and showers, dealing with rusted windowsills and rickety outside porches that pulled away from their unit's exterior, and witnessing gas leaks repaired with duct tape. Tub faucets couldn't be turned off for days, creating more mold. Paint peeled from their walls and tubs and ceilings cracked, and then there were the sewage problems. Every other day I'm unclogging my toilet, complained a resident of Building 16. I even switched toilet paper. Equally aggravating, the resident said, are the indifferent property managers. Resident of Building 41 said, when she calls to report a problem, no one answers. My door has been messed up for over a year, she said. When I call for a work order, they add to the rent for the work, but they don't actually do the work. The residents grew testy but not disrespectful. Throughout the nearly two-hour meeting, they wanted to be heard. We all are somebody, one resident said. We are more than our address, added another. One wondered whether the DHA would have held the meeting if two children hadn't died. A resident of J.J. Henderson Towers housing complex accused the DHA of the cover-up of black babies dying. He also accused the city of coveting the East Durham land McDougall sits on. What you're doing now borders on environmental racism, he said. Make the conditions so bad it's unlivable. We will not stand for another baby to die in McDougall Terrace. The blood is on your hands. Scott denied the DHA wants to repurpose the land. The renovations the DHA plans as part of the housing bond Durham voters passed in November include building on the same site. Ashley Kennedy, the McDougall Residents Council president, told Scott her biggest worry was that residents who spoke out would be evicted for doing so. Scott promised there would be no retaliation. He also said that over the next several weeks he wanted to match residents' work orders with the work they said wasn't being done. That night, a building at McDougall's was evacuated after someone smelled gas. By Friday evening, the DHA was making arrangements for all 348 tenants to relocate until carbon monoxide risks have been eliminated. 40 McDougall residents and their supporters spoke at Monday night's Durham City Council meeting to voice their concerns about living conditions at the housing complex. In response, the council awarded Urban Ministries $90,000 to assist the displaced families. And now to the cover article by the editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Billman. How White Supremacists Won. A Pulitzer Prize winner's extraordinary book shines a light on one of North Carolina's darkest chapters, the 1898 coup that reshaped the state and the South forever. On Thursday, November 10th, 1898, more than 2,000 armed white men, backed by a white supremacist state militia, effected the only successful coup d'etat in American history. They swarmed the city of Wilmington, murdered at least 60 African Americans, forced more than 2,100 black residents to flee, ordered the city's multiracial government and other public officials to resign, more or less, at gunpoint, and replace them with white rulers. No one tried to stop them, and no one was ever held responsible. This insurrection was preceded by a months-long campaign of political violence intended to scare black voters from the ballot box in Wilmington and elsewhere. It worked. 2 days earlier, the white supremacist Democratic Party had reclaimed the legislature from the fusionists after 4 years out of power, thanks to intimidation and outright fraud. The newly re-empowered whites soon passed a constitutional amendment that restricted black access to the polls, and then enacted a series of Jim Crow laws that lived on for decades. Chances are you've heard something about the Wilmington coup, though it's possible you haven't. For such a momentous event in North Carolina's history, it's seldom gotten its historical due. For most of the 20th century, when it was taught in schools, it was taught as a race riot. Blacks rioted and whites restored order. That's how the white insurrectionists framed the day's events, and that's how white newspapermen recorded it at the time. That story is a lie. Blacks didn't riot. If anything, the opposite is true. Even if the word riot deceptively conveys spontaneity, what happened was not spontaneous. It was planned months in advance. In 1951, the white narrative was first challenged in a thesis by Helen Edwards, a black scholar at NC Central. Calling her a negress, Wilmington officials decried her work as distorted and sensational. Efforts to revisit the white narrative resurfaced around the coup's centennial in 1998. 2 years later, the General Assembly created a commission to what happened in Wilmington. In 2006, the commission published its 480-page report showing that the coup was not a race riot, but a documented conspiracy to overthrow a legitimate government. On November 8, 2008, 110 years after the stolen election, Wilmington installed a memorial a block from where the coup's first victims were killed. It reads, Wilmington's 1898 racial violence was not accidental. It began a successful statewide Democratic campaign to regain control of state government, disenfranchise African Americans, and create a system of local segregation which persisted into the second half of the 20th century. Such an extraordinary event with such far-reaching consequences deserves more than a government report. It deserves an extraordinarily compelling exploration. With Wilmington's Lie, the Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy, that's what Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Zucchino has provided. Zucchino, a product of Fort Bragg High School and UNC Chapel Hill, has reported all over the globe over the last four decades, from apartheid South Africa in the 1980s to inner-city Philadelphia, from Lebanon to Iraq. Now a contributing writer for the New York Times, he spent 3 years digging into the story of Wilmington. The result is a work that not only details the brutality of the coup itself, but also the context in which it took place. Last week, I spoke with Zucchino about Wilmington's Lie and why what happened 121 years ago and how we talk about it still matters. This interview has been edited for space and clarity. And now these are question and answer. What drew your interest to Wilmington in 1898? It's this hidden story that's been covered up and mischaracterized for more than a century, a forgotten chapter of not just North Carolina history, but our nation's history. Even a lot of people in North Carolina don't know about this. It wasn't taught in the schools, and if it was taught, it was taught as a response to a black race riot where whites restored order from a corrupt black government. I thought it was remarkable that something like this could happen in the United States. I went to high school and college in North Carolina, and I never heard of it. It was never taught in any history class I ever took. That made me even more determined to bring this to national attention. Next question. Before I read Wilmington's Lie, I was familiar with the basics of the story, but I didn't know about his place in the larger narrative of North Carolina history. Tell us why this insurrection still matters. What the white supremacy campaign of 1898 tried to do was to rob blacks of the vote, and not only the vote, but the right to be hold appointed or political office. They were amazingly successful. This was a huge point in racial history for African Americans in North Carolina and throughout the South. After Reconstruction, blacks had the vote, and there were blacks in Congress. Blacks voted openly. Then, by 1898, through intimidation, through killing some 60 blacks in Wilmington, they kept blacks in North Carolina from voting in any significant numbers from 1898 up until the mid-1960s. In 1896, there were 126,000 registered black voters in North Carolina. By 1902, just 6 years later, there were 6,000. They ended black participation in politics in North Carolina for 70-some years. This spread throughout the South. It wasn't just happening in North Carolina. This event really inspired white supremacy all across the South. What was really significant was that right after the riot, after white supremacists had stolen the 1898 election through fraud, ballot stuffing, and the intimidation of black voters, they passed a law in 1900, the Suffrage Amendment, that basically legally took the vote away from African-American citizens by saying that any person whose grandfather or whose descendant had voted before 1867, which conveniently was the year the blacks got the vote, North Carolina, was not subject to literacy tests and could vote without the literacy tests or the poll tax. And that, of course, disenfranchised just about every black person in North Carolina. Question. By the late 1890s, there was a fusionist governor and general assembly and a black member of Congress from North Carolina, as well as a few black legislators. Blacks were gaining some political power. This whole situation just antagonized white supremacists because through the Redeemer Movement right at the end of Reconstruction in 1876 and up until 1894 in North Carolina, they ran the state government, and why white supremacy was official state policy. But the Democratic Party lost control of the state legislature in 1894 because white populists had been so enraged by how it had been taken over by the banks and railroads and big money interests, they rebelled and combined with Republicans, both black and white, to form fusion. And that put blacks in positions of power not only in the state legislature, but specifically in Wilmington. Wilmington was a rarity at that time. It was a black majority city. There weren't that many in the South. And it had a multiracial government, which was very unusual, and it had a real thriving black middle class and black doctors and lawyers and black policemen and magistrates. This was a primal threat to white supremacy. The whites of North Carolina, specifically of Wilmington, were determined they weren't going to go back. They were going to retake the city. What is unusual about Wilmington versus other so-called race riots is that it wasn't spontaneous. It was premeditated over a period of months, and not only was it premeditated, but they announced what they intended to do. They were going to win by the ballot or the bullet. They said they were going to overthrow the so-called Negro rule, and they did it. Amazingly, they got away with it. No one was ever prosecuted. No one was ever convicted. 60 people were just killed. 60 American citizens killed in broad daylight, and the federal government did nothing. When I started researching this book, I had no idea just how meticulous they were, how they planned everything. One example is they planted all these phony newspaper stories that said blacks were going to riot during and after the election. They were going to rise up. They were stockpiling weapons. They fed these stories to the white reporters coming down from the major newspapers. That became the narrative when, in fact, it was the whites who were stockpiling weapons and who carefully planned this for a specific day, 2 days after the election. Another example of just how orchestrated the thing was, the editor of The Record, the daily black newspaper in Wilmington, had written an editorial in August 1898, well before the November election, where he scandalized whites by suggesting that cases where black men had been lynched for allegedly raping white women were in many cases actually consensual affairs. The so-called red shirts, which was basically the militia of the white supremacy movement, wanted to lynch Alex Manly right away. And the leaders of the movement said, no, this is not the time. We'll have much more impact if we wait until after the election. And at the same time, they had this whole campaign of stump speakers who would go out and really just enrage white audiences with all these tales of black men conniving to steal their jobs, black men coming to steal their women, black beast rapists, Negro rule, and how it was incompetent and criminal. It just built to a crescendo, planned up until the day of the election. They sent red shirts out as night riders into black areas to beat and whip black men and threaten them if they even registered to vote. It really tamped down the black vote and allowed them to win the election. Once they won the election, they were in a position of power to easily overthrow the Wilmington government, just as they had announced they would. Question. You talked about Alex Manly's editorial. It's not the only time in the book where this sort of racial sexual dynamic hits a nerve amongst whites. The reason blacks voting, blacks holding public office was such a threat, it was political power, but it went much deeper. It really pierced the sexual insecurities of white men in the South who absolutely feared black men becoming equal on any footing, whether it was social, economic, or political. Because if a black man rose to power to equal status to that of a white man, he would be competition for the affections of white women. That's why they created this campaign of the so-called black beast rapists, and warning white voters that blacks were coming, not only for their women, but for their jobs. That was a real force in motivating these men. Question. There was a Republican presidential administration in 1898, and there was a fusionist governor who was elected with black votes, both of whom were in a position to help. The white supremacists telegraphed their intentions for months, but no one did anything. How should history look at those who failed to intervene? That's an important aspect of this book. I'll start at the state level. Governor Daniel Russell was from Wilmington. He came from a slaveholding family, so he shared a lot of the racial prejudices of the white supremacy movement, but he was a Republican, and by the standards of the day, he was fairly moderate, and he was a pretty calculating politician. He realized that blacks had the power, through the vote, to put him in office. But then, when the white supremacy campaign started, he was completely intimidated by the white supremacy leaders and backed down at every opportunity to stand up for blacks. He realized that his life was in danger. He had been threatened with assassination. He had been threatened with impeachment. He was terrified, and he rolled over. He saw the whole thing coming and realized very clearly what was going to happen, yet he essentially authorized the killing of black men by giving the white supremacist leaders the power to pull out the state militia in Wilmington. And this was a completely white supremacist militia, even though it was supposed to be a state militia. At the national level, President William McKinley was an abolitionist. Yet I could find no record that he uttered one word in public about the killings and the coup. He just remained silent, even though he had been warned in the months leading up to it many times by America's only black congressman, who was from North Carolina. He did nothing. He did not send troops, as blacks wanted, because Governor Russell was too afraid of antagonizing white supremacists by asking for federal troops. McKinley was preoccupied with the aftermath of the Spanish-American War. I think that played into it. He had also campaigned on binding the nation's wounds from the Civil War. He wanted to bring the country together. He saw the Spanish-American War as actually bringing together Americans from North and South, who for the first time since the Civil War were fighting on the same side. So I think for all those reasons he decided that politically it was not expedient to get involved. Bringing the nation together meant letting the white supremacists have their way. Basically, it's what it amounted to, yeah. Also, like any president, he needed the folks in the South. He was going to run for election in 1900. Question. You covered apartheid South Africa. The white supremacists in Wilmington, this was a movement that brought its own form of apartheid in the U.S. for almost 70 years. What parallels did you see? There were a couple things that I saw in South Africa that happened in 1898. One was the demonizing by race, the belittling, the racial scapegoating and stereotyping by white rulers, courts, white citizens of the country, and just day by day by day turning whites against the black population as a menace, as incompetent, as inferior, and incapable of equality and citizenship. Both the apartheid movements and the white supremacy movement really hit on all these elements. The sexual threat of the so-called black beast rapist in 1898 was repeated under National Party rule when apartheid was coming into play in the early or middle parts of the 20th century, and it was the same playbook. Politically, South Africa used apartheid laws to deny blacks equal rights, and, of course, after the coup, North Carolina passed the suffrage amendment. Question. A federal judge recently struck down North Carolina's voter ID law, citing the state's sordid history with voter suppression. So, this racial history still seems relevant. I wonder what lessons you see from Wilmington that resonate with you. I see white political conservatives still finding ways to disenfranchise black voters or limit their access to the polls. Whether it's pure racism today, as it was in 1898, I can't say. It could just be political opportunism. But regardless of the intent, the effect is to restrict the voting rights of African Americans, and the voter ID law in 2013 was a perfect example. The federal courts ruled that it targeted blacks with, quote, surgical precision. After the ruling, they came up with an amendment that did pass in 2018, and that reminded me so much of the attempt in 1900, successfully, to pass the suffrage amendment, which had the same effect of almost cutting off access to the voting booth to black citizens. So, this is happening again and again. Question. Throughout the book, you see shades of things that are still happening. It's different, but the outlines are familiar. There's the same fear of losing power. I see the echoes of 1898 in the Twitter and Internet universe with the rise of the white nationalist right with the racial and ethnic scapegoating and demonizing online. I mean, just one example was when Donald Trump came down the escalator to announce his run for president. He talked about Mexican criminals and rapists coming across the border to take your jobs, and that's almost word for word from the language of the white supremacists in 1898, when they were warning white voters the same thing about blacks. It's just remarkable how this undercurrent of singling out a group as an enemy and as a target and a scapegoat continues. Alrighty, next we go to a music-related article, which is itself related to an upcoming concert in the Fruit, Durham. Mountain Man Cosmic Prom, which is playing on January 17th through 19th. It's unanimous. The purpose is joy. The three singers of Mountain Man are gathered in the kitchen of the recording studio that one of them, Amelia Meath, is building in the woods in Chapel Hill with Nick Sanborn, her partner in Sylvan Esso. Set to open sometime this year, it will be called Betty's, after Sanborn's grandmother. As work on the studio progresses, the facility is already coming to life. It's where Sylvan Esso, with Mountain Man's Molly Sarley and Alexander Sauser Monig, along with several other friends, stayed and rehearsed before their recent With tour, which sold out two nights at DPAC. Today, it feels good to be inside, watching the gray rain pelt the backyard garden through a window, with steaming mugs of coffee and crunchy snacks on the table. Meath, Sarley, and Sauser Monig are here to talk about Cosmic Prom, their three-night concert art experience slash silly party at The Fruit, January 17th through 19th. Though only Harry Potter, cats, and astrology have been discussed so far, the idle lingua franca of a long friendship. For each night of Cosmic Prom, artist Nan Russell is transforming the warehouse venue into a different whimsical environment. The first night, Beneath the Stars, is camping-themed. Attendees are encouraged to dress up like a starry abyss, your guess is as good as ours, and bring sleeping bags. Night two, Under the Canopy, whisks us to the rainforest. Dress like a tropical creature and bring a plant. Night three is Below the Sea. We hope you have a fish luke and a beach chair, because at the time of this writing, it's the only night that's not sold out. Joy, it says, distilling the point of it all. Joy, Saleh affirms in her higher voice. Joy, says Souser Monique, resolving a canon of accord, albeit promoted by an interviewer who had gotten used to the trio's way of echoing and finishing one another's thoughts. Everyone laughs. There's a lot of laughter when you hang out with Mountain Man. After 10 years, they've grown into their singular band name, harmonizing in conversation as they do in song. Their origin story has been polished to the verge of folklore. They met when Meath overheard Saleh singing Dog Song, the first song she'd ever written, in a Bennington College dorm. Meath asked Saleh to teach it to her, then taught it to her friend, Souser Monique. Rather quickly, the spontaneous trio went from singing folk songs at house parties to releasing their nationally acclaimed 2010 debut, Made the Harbor, and touring with Feist as backup singers. After the unexpected success and college, they scattered to California, Minnesota, North Carolina. But in recent years, the stars have guided them back here, where Meath had established the Grammy-nominated duo Sylvan Esso. After a pivotal outdoor reunion show at Aaron Dessner and Justin Vernon's Eau Claire's Festival in Wisconsin, Mountain Man released its also acclaimed second album, Magic Ship, on the esteemed Nonesuch label in 2018. Now they're coming off of a big 2019 when Saleh and Souser Monique, as Daughter of Swords, both released excellent solo projects. The idea for Cosmic Proms germinated spontaneously, as things do among friends. We all hang out so much and have spent so much of our lives together that sometimes when these ideas come together, it's hard to pinpoint exactly where they came from, Saleh says. In its early days, the trio played by lakes and bonfires in stairwells and tunnels. With some Academy money to spend, the shows are presented by Duke Performances, they seized on the opportunity to bring the great outdoors inside. Most of all, they wanted to have some fun. We've all been working really hard on our own projects this past year, and I think we just wanted to do something that felt pure, Saleh says. We leaned into the whimsical aspect. It felt like we were just kind of spitball dreaming, the most fun sleepover that we could. Like, wouldn't this be funny if it actually happened? To make it happen, they called in a trusted friend, the Indiana-based artist Nan Russell, whose graphic, stylized paintings unshaped plywood cutouts suggested him as the perfect person to turn the fruit into an immersive environment. They gave him free rein. We've been thinking about it as an opportunity to invite people to play in a collective format, and Nat's work is really playful, Souser Monique says. And the more we can find people we truly trust and let them run with the idea, instead of it being like, make the leaf this way, it leads to more exciting and expansive choices. Meath adds. It leads to the environment feeling more alive because it came from multiple minds. With references such as Howard Finster and the stage sets of painter David Hockney in mind, Russell has a simple goal: to be himself. After all, it's why the band entrusted him with this. I'm not the kind of artist that's going to put on a laser light show, he says. I'm going to make things that fit the theme that I think are beautiful and that will complement the vision of these amazing performers. You're going to feel the human hand like a primitive or homemade magic. In addition to the Mountain Man concerts and the environments, the shows will feature surprise guests and DJs each night for chill, non-required but fun dance parties, Meath says. This is a true invitation to create with us by investing in being as weird and far out as you feel like being. They can expect to be immersed in sound and whimsy, Sarlay adds, deadpan. After this magical respite, the members of Mountain Man will be back to business as usual. Saucer Monig and Sarlay are both touring in the early months of 2020. Sylvan Esso is starting to release new music in the first half of the year, leading to a new record in the second half. But today, they're just hanging out on a rainy morning, and the conversation turns to their musical lives before Mountain Man. Saucer Monig grew up in a music store. Meath remembers driving around with a friend in a maroon Mazda Miata, making up electro-clash songs. In high school, Charlet recorded a concept album about global warming with a band called the Tickle Me Hell Knows. Most of this is well-trod ground for the trio, but it turns out that after all this time, they still have things to learn about one another. I played flute in school band, Charlet says quietly. Really? Meath and Saucer Monig reply in chorus. Sarlay even quieter. I was also in jazz band. You were in jazz band? Sarlay. Because of Roger Trip Trapper. Note, the name has been changed, but silliness preserved. Meath. Who the F is Roger Trip Trapper? Roger Trip Trapper was the boy I had a crush on in sixth grade, and he was in jazz band. He played the clarinet. The conversation goes like this for some time, like it could wind on forever, a thread stitching three friends' voices and lives together, tighter and tighter as time goes on. Music is the outcome, but the purpose is joy. We were just babies when we started out, and our personalities kind of grew around each other, Meath says, growing solemn. Molly and Alexander's influence has been deeply rooted in my life, and I see it more as I get older. The way you move around the world is strongly influenced by the people you surround yourself with. It's really like they've raised me. Everyone embraces. This year is our 10th anniversary as friends, which is very significant to me, Meath says. It is significant, Saucer Moaning agrees. Very significant, Charlie concludes. And now from the art section, Project Lax, through June 28th at the Ackland Art Museum in Chapel Hill. This is written by Jamila F. Dallas. The immortal Henrietta Lax, an Afrofuturist art collective, invents a new language for a true story of science, consent, and survival. Henrietta Lax died nearly 70 years ago, but some people say that she lives to this day. No, this is the ghost story, but it is a story about a kind of immortality. It's also the subject of Project Lax, LHAXX, a polyglot exhibit at Ackland Art Museum. Lax, a 31-year-old mother of five, was treated at the Johns Hopkins Hospital for cervical cancer, which took her life in 1951. For years, George Gay, G-E-Y, a cancer and virus researcher, had been collecting cells from biopsies of cervical cancer patients. Lax was the first person whose cells did not die in the lab. Instead, they doubled every 20 to 24 hours. Her name survives in her immortal cell line, which is called HeLa, H-E-L-A. It played a significant part in the development of the polio vaccine and is still used to study the effects of new treatments on cancer cells without experimenting on humans. But Lax's story is inseparable from issues of consent, ownership, and the troubling history of medical experimentation on black bodies. Gay took her cells without her or her family's knowledge, which was standard procedure. Lax's family didn't know her cells had been critically important to medical research until the mid-1970s. These cells have created a billion-dollar industry. At least 11,000 patents contain them, but her children have not, and likely will never, benefit financially from their mother's genetic material. Her story is part of the inspiration behind Project Lax, a site-specific installation in the Ackland's Arts and Community Space. It was created by Charlotte visual artists Marcus Kaiser and Jason Woodbury, and Durham performance artist Quentin Talley, collaborating as Intergalactic Soul. They approach Lax's story through an Afrofuturist lens. Afrofuturism is about preserving black spaces in the future, Kaiser says. It's the idea of preserving the culture and making sure we still have a voice, that we're still heard and we're controlling our own narrative. The mixed media installation fills an entire gallery wall. Indecipherable gold glyphs are striking against a black background with elliptical, sculptural neon lights at the center. The lights represent stars Sirius A and B and the Dogon people of Mali, who knew about the white dwarf Sirius B centuries before it was recognized by 19th century astronomers. A cosmic message accessible via the free augmented reality app Artivive accompanies the installation. Woodbury calls the mysterious markings hieroglyphs from future ancestors, evidence of survival. He says he was compelled to develop them because he realized that, quote, African Americans are the only people in this country without a native language. The glyphs are inspired by languages from the regions of Woodbury's ancestry, including Nyo from West Africa and early forms of Irish. Kaiser, Woodbury, and Tolley were also inspired by Alicia Wormsley's evolving project, There Are Black People in the Future, an exhibit they saw years ago in Charlotte. Well, I have only about a minute remaining, and I must cut this article from Indie Week short. Today's program, read for a blind and print-impaired audience, will be available all week as a podcast after this initial broadcast on our website. And now for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly Triangle Radio Reading Service, I'm John Federson, wishing everyone so long till next time.